Hey guys, I wanted to tell you about another podcast that I'm working on with Evergreen Podcasts. I'm the producer of the true crime podcast, Crime Capsule. Writer and host Benjamin Morris takes listeners deep into some of history's most compelling crimes. Each episode will provide a unique perspective on true crime as Morris interviews the authors who have written extensively about everything from the Dixie Mafia to the Thibodeau Massacre. Crime Capsule is an Evergreen Podcast production in partnership with the History Press and Arcadia Publishing. So we will have an endless and diverse catalog of books to explore. From forgotten serial killers to advancements in DNA, I can guarantee you, Crime Capsule will have an episode for everyone. If you're looking for a new show to listen to during the holidays, then download Crime Capsule today at killerpodcasts.com or on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever it is you find your favorite shows. Crime Capsule is part of Killer Podcasts, the new true crime network from Evergreen. Please join us every Thursday for new episodes. Crime Capsule. History so interesting, it's criminal.
3 a.m., the comedy horror podcast that holds weekly gatherings around the campfire. Let me tell you what you're going to get. You're going to hear stories about demonic possessions, prison stabbings, skinwalkers, glitches in the Matrix, cult leaders, missing 411, Night Marchers, Operation Paperclip, Mesopotamian devil worship, and so many monsters it'll give Kanye West a runaway for his money. Pop and meme culture also aren't off topic. A camp where laughs and scares are constantly competing for first place. We're just a group of friends, trying to bust each other's balls, find the best stories, and expand the circle in the process. 3 a.m., the comedy horror podcast, not for the faint or fragile of heart. Let's go.
Slow Burn Media, an Evergreen podcast, presents Who Killed? A podcast that provides a voice for the voiceless.
Past Santa Claus in his sleigh and a double row of candy canes, deputy coroners brought the body of 6-year-old JonBenet Ramsey from her upscale home. Neighbors described the young girl as beautiful and polite. In 1995, she won the Little Miss Colorado pageant. Boulder police won't comment on her cause of death, only saying that she wasn't shot or stabbed. They are investigating her death as a homicide. So far, no arrests have been made.
This case started as a kidnapping. Police were called here to the scene at about 6 a.m. the morning after Christmas. Someone inside this house had made a 911 call saying that little JonBenet had been kidnapped. Well, when police got here, they went inside the house, and a short time later, they found the little girl's body. The parents, John and Patsy Ramsey, were home at the time, but detectives say the parents are not suspects.
The father is the president of Access Graphics, located on Boulder's Pearl Street Mall. The couple does have another child, a son around 10 years old. Whether the boy is a suspect, investigators won't comment, saying only that right now, this murder investigation is wide open. In Boulder, Phil Keating, 9 News.
How do you want JonBenet remembered? How do you remember her?
Well, I mean, like all parents would say, she was a perfect child, but the thing that I remember about her was that if I would frown, she would look at me and say, "Dad, I don't like that face." And I'd smile and she said, "That's better." And that's just the way she was.
She loved her daddy. She loved her daddy. She was daddy's girl.
Miss Ramsey, you found the note. It was a handwritten note, 3 pages.
The note was lying across the 3 pages across the run of one of the stair treads. And it was kind of dimly lit. It was very early in the morning. And I started to read it, and it was addressed to John. It said, "Mr. Ramsey." And it said, "We have your daughter." And I, you know, it just wasn't registering. And I may have gotten through another sentence, like, "We have your daughter," and I I don't know if I got any further than that. And I immediately ran back upstairs and pushed open her door, and she was not in her bed.
Hello and welcome to episode 147 of Who Killed? I'm your host, Bill Huffman, and this is a Slow Burn Media and Evergreen Podcasts production. On this week's episode, we are going to be diving into one of the most infamous Christmas murders of all time, if not the most infamous, and that is JonBenet Ramsey. And luckily, we don't have Santa Claus with us, but we have the next best thing, and that is the captain. Welcome to the show.
He's equally as fat and equally as jolly.
Well, he's also bearded, like the captain.
Yeah, but I don't like when people sit on my lap, so.
Touche. I would say that is not a good look. So, yeah. At CrimeCon, don't be doing that.
No sitting on the captain's lap.
No sitting on the captain's lap. He's not Santa Claus. But we are here to discuss the 25-year anniversary of the JonBenet Ramsey murder that occurred on December 25th, 1996. I cannot believe it's been a quarter century since this crime was committed.
Well, and technically, a lot of people believe the crime was committed on the 26th, but she made sure that the date of her daughter's death was on Christmas.
Okay.
I think technically the autopsy would show that she died on the 26th, but her birth or her gravestone says the 25th.
Gotcha. Now, I thought it was that she actually, was it Christmas Eve that she was killed, or was it Christmas Day?
It would have been Christmas night.
Christmas night. Okay.
Yeah. So they woke up, opened their gifts, went to a party, came back from the party.
Right.
And they had parties all week, and I think that's where some people get confused, because they had a party a couple days beforehand at their house.
Mm-hmm.
But all week, you know, they're in a rich neighborhood with rich friends, and they all want to invite people over. Hey, come to my house and let me show you off what we've been doing to the house.
Yeah, I think they actually did have like a Christmas tour for the city of Boulder. I think their house was one of the houses along the way. And so you had strangers coming in and seeing, just like you said, you know, it was an affluent neighborhood. I mean, again, the city of Boulder, great city, in the mountains, Colorado, attracts a lot of people. And yeah, people like to show off what they're doing. And especially in the Ramsey's case, I mean, John was a very successful executive. And
what's always been crazy to me about the case is when you initially see the house, it looks relatively small.
It does.
It looks like a quaint little house. And then when you see the side of it, you're like, oh, this is like an 8,000 square foot house.
Yeah, because it's hard to put $7 million house and something along those lines. And it didn't look like that from the front. But again, where your location is in the mountains, in that type of neighborhood,
yeah,
you don't really expect things like this to happen. No, nobody really ever expects anything like this to happen. But, you know, Patsy, like you said, they went to the party. Yes, it was the 26th. And yes, I would say on the gravestone, it probably is the 26th.
No, the gravestone is 25th.
Oh, it is the 25th. Okay.
Yeah, so they basically, you know, she falls asleep coming home from the party. So mm-hmm. John takes her up and puts her to bed. Burke stays up. John's not, I don't think he's feeling so well. I don't know if he had a cold. They claim he had a cold. I wonder if he just had too many cocktails at the party and decided to turn in early, because they were going to fly, I believe, back to Atlanta the next day.
They were either going to Atlanta or they were going to Michigan, one of the two.
Okay, yeah, because I believe they had a cabin in Michigan.
Yeah, in Charlevoix.
Then, yeah, so you're probably right. It's probably Michigan. And then, so they put her to bed. Burke's still up. Patsy's doing, you know, do the mom thing. We got to get ready because we're going to leave really early in the morning. And then when she goes to bed, then something happens. So that's why it's like, I think you put her in bed about like 10:30, 11 o'clock. And so whatever happened probably happened the next day. But look, if that happens to your daughter and you want to put 25th on the gravestone instead of 26, I'm not going to argue with you.
Yep. Yeah, I'm not going to argue with you on that one at all, because, you know, the one thing that they always talk about with this case and the thing that has always kind of lingered is, you know, people always like, oh, was it Patsy? Was it, you know, was she the one that committed this crime? And, you know, I just have trouble wrapping my head around a parent doing this. And
yeah, there's actually a significant amount of cases due to, like, potty training, like a lot of accidental deaths where parents get fed up. I mean, it's not like a huge number, but I remember looking it up or being told by a detective one time what the statistics were, and it was like way higher than I thought it would be. So I think a lot of people started leaning towards the idea because JonBenet was having a lot of issues with wetting the bed, that she just got fed up and lashed out, and then it was an accidental death. And that was kind of the narrative for a while. Even, I think, Boulder police were kind of pushing that narrative.
Yes.
There was an accident. I mean, interesting for them to not even go, hey, we're not going to even blame the family so much, but to say, hey, it was an accident, but what we're blaming for you is that you're covering it up. Then the narrative started changing throughout the years, because I think it was just earlier that year, Burke hit his sister JonBenet with a golf club in the face.
So then the narrative, whether or not that was that an intentional, or was he inflicting, you know, was it an attack? Or, I mean, I'm sure the parents had questions about that.
Yeah, it's weird because, like, with my siblings and stuff, when we were kids, there were times where people were, like, swinging the bat.
Sure, my sister got drilled with the yellow wiffle ball bat.
Yeah, I got hit one time with a metal bat.
Oh, good.
Right in the back. But, you know, it's like, and my story is that my brother did it on purpose. His story was I was swinging the bat and you backed up into it. So that's why I questioned. But then, CBS, you know, my father's a detective, and out of all the cases that we've covered, I probably talked to him the most about JonBenet Ramsey before we even started the podcast. It's just something we talked about. But my father has done a lot of work where they'll send him case files and say, hey, we're working on this thing. Can you take a look at it and see what direction we should go in? And because of his involvement in the FOP, he became friends with a couple detectives in Boulder. So he would send information to them. I mean, obviously this was all, like, you know, approved. So the fact that he was just friends with these guys, he was never privy to case information. But because he was friends with them, he was really fascinated with that case. And so when the CBS the documentary came out, to me and my father and so many other people that watched it, it was like, okay, well, they pretty much proved that it was that Burke hit her in the head with a flashlight, and then the parents decided to cover it up, which at the time it made a lot of sense. But the more that I started researching the case, the more I was like, this is all, they left out so much stuff.
Yeah, and that was a very controversial in 2016. The CBS documentary came out, and I know that Jim Clemente was involved with it.
Yeah,
and you know, they had the one doctor, one forensic examiner, come out and say, "Yeah, basically, we think it was Burke, and this is why." And of course, that led to a massive lawsuit from Burke. Now, generally speaking, when people say they're going to sue and they don't, that's a sign that they didn't do anything, you know, that they're potentially guilty. But no, he sued, and they followed through, and they ended up settling out of court.
Well, and that's not the only case that he's settled. He's sued so many people, Rag Mags, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And
Star Magazine.
Yeah, and you can't, because obviously they settled out of court, you don't know the number. But my calculations, if just the ones that he settled and then they paid him, I mean, he could be worth over $100 million.
Yeah, because, I mean, you really don't go on national or international television and accuse a 9-year-old kid of murdering his sister. It's just irresponsible, in my opinion. But, yeah. Hey, you know, the producers make that call, and sometimes they make the wrong call. I mean, Dan Rather's career got ruined by situations like this. So,
yeah, the other thing, too, I did a talk in Champaign, Illinois with my friend Kelly from True Crime in Real Life. And one of the things that has really been bothering me lately, and maybe it's because I'm connected to I'm a son of a detective, and a lot of his friends will listen to the show, and if they know anything about the case, maybe comment later, you know, if we're out having a beer. But I start questioning, like, I mean, the category or the genre we're in is true crime. And a lot of these cases, now I know you did a deep dive with Amy Mihaljevic's case, but I would say that case in particular was a true story with no, like, one person running the narrative. It seemed to me, an outsider, it seemed like it was pretty wide open. But you take a case like Mara Murray, it seems like people are trying to control the narrative. Or Brian Schaefer, people try to control the narrative. JonBenet Ramsey was definitely one that, depending on who told you the story, was going to be, would depend on who you thought was guilty.
Mm-hmm.
And so I've been questioning so much, because it seems like every time we dive into a case, I'm going, this is not the narrative that I heard for 10 years or what, you know what I mean? However long the case was around. So then I start questioning our genre. Is this even true crime, or is it just
speculation?
This is basically what we know, crime. This is all the information we have, crime.
It is very much, I would say, the genre is very problematic in a way, because
ever since you got involved.
Yeah, ever since I got involved. And I would say, I mean, it's problematic in a sense that if you don't take these cases responsibly, you don't respect the people, the families, the victims, and you throw out a bunch of speculation, I think that is an irresponsible way of going about it. You know, I'm a professionally trained journalist, so I try to avoid getting involved with too much speculation. But again, with cases like JonBenet or Maura Murray, like you said, there are narratives that people want to put out there. They want to say, oh, it was the mom. No, they want to say it was Burke. No, they want to say, you know, it was a combination of the two.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's kind of like what's going on with Delphi also at the moment, with, like, there are, you know, every person who has a sexual offense towards a child becomes a suspect. And a lot of that happened in the Benet, you know, JonBenet case, once the focus eventually began to move away from the parents. And, you know, so it'd be like, oh, this is a sex offender lived within 7 miles of the of the home. And it's like, well, how would he have gotten in, and when would he have known this, and what's the deal with the ransom note? I mean, the ransom note itself is you could do a whole show on the ransom note.
Oh, just, yeah. I mean, you could. Well, one, what I learned, or what I feel like I learned from diving into the case, is when the cops come out and say it must have been an intruder, or no, it must have been somebody in the house, because there was no footprints in the snow. Right away, as armchair detective, you go, there's no footprints in the snow. Right? So it had to be somebody from in the house. But they left out the important part of that information they gave you. There also wasn't any snow. So, yeah, there's no footprints in the snow, but there's no snow. So once you start finding out that the police were putting out information like that, it blows my mind. It's almost like, and my father just talked to me about this a long time, is they'd have multiple detectives on a case. And if one of them started getting fixated on a suspect or fixated on an idea, that guy needs to get off the case. But it almost seems like in the JonBenet Ramsey case, they got fixated on this idea that it had to be somebody inside the house. And I just don't think there's any proof of it. It's just like when that stupid detective lady comes out and says that she was fearing for her life. And the day that they found JonBenet, they show up. The police show up. They think it's a kidnapping. They do search the house. But the police officer that went down to the basement, there was a door that was jammed.
Mm-hmm.
If he would have got that door open, we would have had a crime scene that we could have, it would have been a pristine crime scene. Because basically they could have opened up the door and say, don't go in here. And just only let the technicians go in there. But he couldn't get the door open. So then they started acting as if it was a kidnapping. And then, so she's saying, we're acting like it's a kidnapping. We haven't found the child yet. And once they find the child, then she's saying that she's fearing for her life. The detective is fearing for her life. And she's counting the bullets that she has to make sure she has enough bullets. That's not true. All of her early statements, she was in favor of it being an intruder.
Sure.
But that doesn't sell a book. So that was like her sales pitch. I was in that house counting my bullets. And you're like, cool, I want to read that book. And that's the other problem with this, because the case was so big and probably the biggest case.
Hello, this is Dr. Grande, the host of True Crime Psychology and Personality. On my podcast, I explore and explain the pathology behind some of the most horrendous crimes and those who commit them. We discuss topics like narcissism, psychopathy, sociopathy, and antisocial personality disorder from a scientifically informed perspective. What is a narcissist? How do you spot a sociopath? What signs can you look for to protect yourself from these dangerous personalities? It's not just about the stories, but also the science and psychology behind them. So if you're interested in true crime or mental health, I'd encourage you to give my show a listen wherever you get podcasts.
Ever.
Let's hear from this week's sponsor, BetterHelp.com. We may have moved past 2020, but 2021 is still looking fairly grim. But today I'm happy to tell you about BetterHelp.com. Because if there's anything holding you back or interfering with your happiness, BetterHelp Online Counseling is there for you. You can connect with a professional counselor in a safe and private online environment. And it's really convenient because in this current state that we live in, it just has to be. So now you can get help on your own time at your own pace. All you have to do is schedule a secure video or phone session, or you can chat and text with your therapist. BetterHelp really is there for you. They have over 3,000 U.S. licensed therapists across all 50 states. And if for whatever reason you aren't happy with your counselor, you can request a new one at any time. So if you're suffering from depression or anxiety, stress, anger, relationship issues, heck, you're not getting a good night's sleep, or have LGBT matters, or just low self-esteem, they literally have a licensed professional counselor for you. And of course, everything you share is confidential. The thing I like the most is it's actually affordable. And Who Killed listeners get 10% off their first month with the discount code WHO. So why not get started today? Go to betterhelp.com/WHO. All you have to do is fill out a questionnaire to help them assess your needs, and then you get matched with a counselor you'll love. Again, for 10% off, go to betterhelp.com/WHO. All right, we are back.
Yeah. I can't think of one bigger.
I can't either. I mean, and you got to think that the investigators in that town, I mean, we're not talking about necessarily the Keystone Cops, but
Right.
There were some questionable decisions made, you know, along the lines of what did.
It was also in the 90s, so I'm guessing that the average law enforcement agent on that case was making less than six figures.
Oh, sure.
And you know as well as I do, like, there's not a ton of money in books, but but there's probably six figures in books if it goes well. So somebody says, hey, let's get you to write a book, and that gives you 2 or 3 years worth of your salary. Sure.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of these cops were willing to say whatever they wanted to. So they acted like they never checked the house. They did.
Mm-hmm.
They then basically make it seem that they never talked to Burke. They talked to Burke the day they found JonBenet. JonBenet's parents, if Burke did it, if it was an accident, why would they let him go to their friend's house? And why would they let law enforcement talk with him for hours without them being present? To me, that makes no logical sense. You wouldn't want to leave that 9-year-old in a room. And yes, then later they didn't let law enforcement talk with Burke, but they already initially did.
Yeah.
So if I'm his parents, I'm going, look, you talked to him for a couple hours, you should have all the information you need. But also, you know, then on the flip side, when you look at the family, like, pretty quickly, there's that one documentary where one of their friends called them and said, hey, I have some inside information. The cops are trying to pin this on you guys right now, like early on. So one, why did law enforcement jump to this conclusion and just start doubling down? And then again, I agree with the family. If you know this is happening, lawyer up, plain and simple. But I mean, it's just such an odd case. And like I said, if that door just would have opened, I don't think we'd be sitting here with no answers. And
yeah.
And then it's just like with Delphi, I actually think, you know, not to jump cases, but that one, we've had so much information in the last couple of weeks come out about that case, or possibly about that case. I keep on going back to where law enforcement states, well, we had over 100 FBI agents that first week. And I start going, well, was that just too many? These are very experienced law enforcement agents, but maybe they're just too many. Because if I go interview 3 eyewitnesses and you go interview a different 3 eyewitnesses and nothing sticks out as weird because I don't know their stories. So I can trust the information that you got, but I wasn't in the room, so I might not be able to hear the discrepancies in the details. So, you know, but to me, since we covered the case, you know, on True Crime Garage, we did 6 episodes on the JonBenet Ramsey case, and I was hoping to, like, have an actual opinion, because that's why people are tuning in. And the only conclusion I ever came to with that case was that she was viciously murdered. There's no accident there. I mean, because if she fractures her skull before she's dead, there's blood everywhere. And think about, like, that bleach blonde hair. I had a buddy one time had this similar type of hair. He, you know, got a little cut on his head, and it was just like gushing blood everywhere, and his, like, hair was, like, turning pink. And
I had bright blonde hair when I was a kid, and I had multiple head injuries, which would explain a lot. And
makes a lot of sense.
It's definitely not a good look to be bleeding with blonde hair.
Yeah, and also, just like when you start reviewing the autopsy and they start talking about the half moons around her neck, because one of the ropes or string, however you want to view it, was so buried into her neck that you couldn't even see it. So there's, like, one that's almost invisible, and then the other one, like, you can see on top. But there's all these half moons around it. And so, again, learn the information, call my father. Hey, Dad, what do half moons mean? Oh, it means that somebody was struggling, like to pull the rope off themselves. So you'd be struggling, and so you'd be embedding your nails, and your nails would leave normally like half moons.
Okay, that makes sense.
Sometimes they'll see the half moons on the actual killer because the person put up a fight and maybe wasn't able to scratch, but was just digging their nails into their murderer. So, but I mean, every detective I talk to and some people that I know that are going to school for forensics, I mean, you say half moons, that like instantly the person was struggling. So my theory is somebody choked her to death. So here's the other thing. When I was giving that talk in Champaign a couple weeks ago, some people go, I love your show, but I disagree with you on JonBenet Ramsey. And I'm like, well, who do you think killed, you know, and they'll say Patsy or John or whoever. And I'm like, but I never gave a theory because I don't know who killed her. Like, all I know is that she was viciously murdered. And that doesn't rule out Patsy, and that doesn't rule out John.
Yeah.
I mean, I lean away from them because, like you said, I just don't see... It's less likely that a parent's going to viciously murder their child like that.
And for the circumstances that we're talking about, I mean, what they bring up as a motive potentially is the bedwetting scenario that you brought up earlier in the episode. And it's just like... Okay, yeah, there's been cases that parents get out of control, but there's never been any, you know, Burke has said many times, and basically Burke was like, we never got spanked, we were never,
yeah,
you know, there was never any finger put on us. So,
well, and that's other information that was leaked to the media by law enforcement was that there was chronic sexual abuse to JonBenet, and that just was not true.
That was not true.
That what they think happened, they call it digital
penetration.
Digital penetration, which normally means that you were penetrated by a finger, but all they could see is possibly that she was molested the day of her murder, that there was some kind of molestation the day of her murder. And possibly a couple days beforehand because there was bruising. But some of those doctors have said, well, there's definitely some kind of digital molestation or digital penetration. The bruising could have been from bedwetting, or there can be some bruising to that area even if you're just wiping too hard.
Gotcha.
So that's where it gets a little convoluted, but I lean towards the idea, look, they had all these family parties. Most likely the killer would have known her, would have been obsessed with her, possibly touched her a couple days beforehand, maybe even got scared that she was going to tell people. I think where it gets really confusing is I don't think whoever killed her planned on killing her in the house.
I don't think there was even that. Yeah, I mean, that's an interesting take, but it really is. I think what you mentioned about having somebody possibly have molested her a few days before and then coming back to, you know, silence her in a sense.
Right.
I think that actually makes a lot of sense in a way, because they did have family parties, work parties. They had, you know, that tour, like we said. And again, like we mentioned before, or we didn't mention, I'm not sure, but the pageants, you know, the beauty pageants. I mean, she was not just some normal little girl. She was paraded around as a young little adult. And those videos are very disturbing. And if you're like, looking at it in hindsight, I mean, they're probably disturbing either way, but how easily it would have been for somebody just to go to one of those shows and see this girl dressed up like a woman, and it's like boom, the fantasy is kicked off, and now he's got an obsession. And
yeah, the thing that's so disturbing in that case to me is the argument she got in with her friend's mom. It was a few days before Christmas. She was telling her friend, you know, they had a little play date, and she's like, hey, Santa Claus is going to come visit me after Christmas and give me a gift. And the mom said, well, hold on a second. No, Santa Claus comes on Christmas. Like, he's bringing you. And she said, no. Santa Claus told me that he's coming to visit me after Christmas. And he's going to give me a gift. And so the fact that then she ends up dead after Christmas, essentially.
Mm-hmm.
Because, I mean, look, whether it's 9 o'clock at night, 10 o'clock at night, 11 o'clock at night, that's after Christmas. Christmas is normally a morning type thing. You might have Christmas dinner.
Sure.
But, you know, when I was growing up, we'd wake up as early as we could, open up the gifts, and by noon, we're like, okay, we're done with this. You know, Christmas is kind of over, and you're just kind of... And even in college, we used to do this thing where we'd have a Christmas barbecue at night because everybody... You'd go home and visit your family, but you'd be like, oh, now it's 5 o'clock at night, bored.
Oh, yeah.
Have a barbecue.
Christmas night out. I mean, yeah. I wouldn't be a 20-something and, you know, not go to the bars after Christmas dinner or whatever. Yeah. I mean, that's why they're open. And again, that's just what you did when you were in your 20s. And
well, and so to me, it's just such a... When that information came out, to me, it's like, that was powerful, too. Especially because we have a really polite kid.
Sure.
And that the fact that she's going to be willing to speak up and go, no, 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 no. Don't correct me. I know what I heard.
Right. And I was just going to say that they did have somebody playing Santa Claus, and that was the neighbor, Bill McReynolds.
Yeah, and... Look, a lot of times it points to him because of that. Who was Santa that told her this? Was it Bill? But also, she was in this Christmas pageant. Was it somebody working the Christmas pageant? Was it some guy that went to the pageant dressed up as Santa? Because a lot of those pageants are like in malls and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So
sure.
Did some guy just put on a Santa suit and he could sit there and not look... I mean, yeah, he'd look strange because he was in a Santa suit, but maybe he wouldn't look strange for just watching these little kids being paraded around like show ponies.
Yeah, that would definitely not be a... I mean, again, having these things at the mall, that is another thing that is just disturbing.
Yeah, it's weird. It's weird about the pageants because I don't know... I don't know. I mean, I started teaching like kids. Oh, did you hear? Hear barking?
I did.
Yeah, I have a rescue dog. It's not been going well.
Hey, it's our PSA for the week.
It's a really good dog, but it was one of those things where people are saying, hey, we need to rescue this dog. They're going to put it to sleep tonight. And they made it seem like if I just take the dog for a couple days that if they can't find a home, that they'll take it to another rescue or something. And I have not heard back from them, and it's been over 2 weeks. So I don't know what I'm going to do with this dog.
Ownership's 9/10 of the law. Or possession's 9/10 of the whatever.
Well, I told him, you know, not to get too off subject, but I was like, I'm going to be traveling a lot. I can't. And nobody that I know is going to take the dog. I can't leave it in my house for 3 days by itself. The captain was arrested on animal cruelty. So I don't know where I sit on these pageants because, like I said, I used to teach guitar lessons. Like I think I started when I was 18, and a lot of my friends were like early 20s, and they'd be like, oh, man, I got a couple cute students or hot students. And I'm like, my students were 16 or even 17. So in the real world, 18-year-old kid dating a 17-year-old is not that big of a deal. When you're their teacher, even if you're just their guitar instructor, to me that's creepy.
All right, that will do it for part one of The Captain and Who Killed JonBenet Ramsey. Tune in for the conclusion on New Year's Eve. And also, don't forget to check out my newest podcast, Big Mountains and Old Friends, starting on December 28th. I will be traveling the country and visiting some of the best ski resorts in North America, and I will be podcasting all the way across the country. Thank you to the captain for joining me for a special holiday episode of Who Killed. He's a very busy man with a very successful show, so I suggest everybody check out truecrimegarage.com. And thank you to betterhelp.com for sponsoring this week's episode. If you'd like to save 10%, please use my promo code WHO. As you know, I drop new episodes of Who Killed every Friday. So if you enjoy this podcast, as well as the other shows that I produce and host, you can help support independent journalism by using my PayPal username, @WilliamHuffman3. Or you can contribute to the show via the Venmo app with my username @Bill-Huffman-3. I say it every week, but every contribution, big or small, does help keep these slow burn media podcasts running. You can help support the show by leaving a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts or wherever it is you listen to your favorite shows. Those 5 stars help keep the important cases I cover, such as all the unsolved cases I've covered in the spotlight. If you'd like to stay up to date on the cases I have covered, as well as the new shows I have coming down the pipeline, you can always follow me on Twitter @BillHuffman3. It is a wild card. You never know what you're going to get. Thank you so much again for listening. I hope everyone has a Merry Christmas and a Happy Holiday. Until next time, as always, be healthy and stay safe.
On the morning of August 1st, 1966, shots ring out from the observation deck of the clock tower on the University of Texas campus. It marks the infamous beginning of the modern era of mass shootings in America.
You're listening to Stop the Killing podcast. Join us as we take you behind the crime scene tape to explain global mass shootings and mass attacks. I'm Sarah Ferris, but more importantly, this is Catherine Schweit, the former head of the FBI's active shooter program.
I spent 5 years as the FBI's top executive looking for answers to the mass shooting crisis. I've been at the shooting scenes. I've traced heroic acts of bravery. And I've sat silently and listened to the heart-wrenching stories from survivors.
Amongst this horror, there is hope. We all hold the key to stop the killing. You just need to know how to unlock the door. Download Stop the Killing and be part of the solution. Search Stop the Killing on Apple, Spotify, and all the usual suspects.
Something is creeping in. Don't follow it down.
Let me introduce you to Barry Clue, an authorised financial advisor from New Zealand and a very special kind of stain on humanity.
He was a very knowledgeable young guy.
He was a registered financial advisor.
Type of guy that was bending over backwards to help you.
Now, you could be forgiven for thinking that Barry sounds like a great guy, and you'd be right. Well, right up until the point when you're wrong.
It was all fictitious.
You stole from my son, who has a disability.
Chris never knew. He died believing that we're all taken care of.
A psychopath is somebody who lacks empathy, acts impulsively. I think there's a strong case that Barry might be all of those things, actually.
To find out how Barry Clue stole over $15 million from 81 victims, subscribe to Clueless, The Long Con. That's Clueless, spelt Klooghless.